Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. I have the distinct pleasure of speaking today with Dr. Adhish Sate. He's Associate Professor of Sanskrit Literature and South Asian Folklore at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Hello, Adhish, and welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Raj, for having me on. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's kind of an honor to be on it myself.
Well, before diving into this fascinating book, which you probably have all seen by the icon, Crossing the Lines of Caste, Vishvamitra and the Construction of Brahmin Power in Hindu Mythology, before we dive into the timeless tale of Vishvamitra, tell us about your podcasting experiences, adventures. You probably have been doing somewhat more of it in the age of COVID-19, I imagine.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, we've all had to become, you know, podcasters or YouTubers due to the current crisis, but I guess I anticipated it for some strange reason. And since 2016, I've been doing video lectures for my courses. So kind of creating YouTube videos that's tried to succinctly boil down, you know, centuries of mythology and cultural history for undergraduates.
That's really cool. We'll be sure to link your videos to this podcast so folks can check those out as well. And the same year in 2016, I started doing online teaching, and really I was sort of lost in the wilderness a bit. I had really no real context for what was happening until now, but it seems coincidentally I had been preparing for what's happening currently. In terms of engaging learners through distance learning and being a little bit ahead of the curve with podcasts. But it's really great. I think the students really appreciate it. And it sort of, it bespeaks the transformation afoot on our globe, across our globe, that even folks who are at the academy, not just, younger, more agile scholars like yourself, but really across the globe, folks are really embracing distance learning and podcasts. Just by chance, I asked New Books Network for numbers for this podcast. It's quadrupled to quintupled in the last 3 months, listenership.
Incredible, incredible.
Folks want something to do, so I half joked on my last podcast that this was my contribution to the war effort, picking up podcast speed. So enough about you and your interesting curve, embracing distance learning and podcasting.
Well, I just want to say one thing on that is that this is really not only just the future based on the current crisis that we're in, but our students and the next generation are fundamentally, they have a virtual identity alongside a tangible physical one. So it's really important, I think, to embrace that side of the learning process, the online dimension of learning.
Yeah, I really respect that. I'll say, I'll be very forthcoming that I had the very good fortune of having direct teaching both at the academy and also in oral lineage and parampara and in a variety of spaces, workshops and all kinds of training. And I was actually really prejudicial towards thinking that online learning couldn't be impactful. I was proven wrong, actually, to the point that even one-on-one consulting and coaching I do online now, and it's equally impactful. And not to say that that there's any replacement for certain avenues of in-person embodied experience, but nevertheless, I surprised myself at how much one could accomplish and how much one can impact the life of learners through the online medium. I imagine it's been similar in your journey as well.
No, absolutely. And it's a learning process on how to integrate virtual media as well as in class and in person embodied learning, as you're saying. Absolutely.
Sure. Now, you've written this fascinating book. I mean, of course, I'd probably use the word fascinating for every book I interview, because in my view, they are. But if you're anything like me, and that's probably why you're listening to this podcast, you're a Hindu studies nerd or a South Asian religion aficionado of sorts. And so you would find this fascinating. As you know, I have a variety of guests, ethnography, modern, pre-modern, ancient Indian. But today we get to talk about the wonderful world of ancient Indian myth. Adisha's written a fascinating study of this character, Vishwamitra. Although it's been published in 2015, really in the course of three millennia of religious history, it's a new book, for sure. It was actually this book in part that got me thinking that one day I wanted to do a quote-unquote mapping Markandeya project. And then I got to speak with Brian Collins the other day about his book on the mythology of Parashurama, where we mentioned Adisha's work. And I mentioned then that I think I'm satisfied with my mapping Markandeya chapter. Maybe it's too onerous to try and map the life of a character like Vishwamitra, but luckily someone else has done it. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, how this sort of the genesis of the project before we dive into what the book's actually about.
Well, I could. Do you want the long story or the short story of the genesis of the project?
I've got time. You've got time. I've got an hour and 45 minutes. You can start with creation if you wish. You can start with your dissertation.
Why don't I start at the beginning then and I'll be mapping the Vishwamitra in this sense. So it started in an odd way in 1998 when I was a master's student and I spent some time in Pune. My mom, who is still alive at the time, she said, go to my best friend Saroja Bhatte, and she'll help you learn Sanskrit. So I showed up at Saroja Bhatte's office. At that time she was the professor, department head at Pune University of the Sanskrit department. And I said, you know, here I am, the son of your best friend, ready to learn. And I was interested in Ramayana at the time and epics in general, Mahabharata, Ramayana, and stories, more broadly speaking, in how stories have constructed our understanding of social power, society, history, and so on. And she said, why don't you just read the Balakanda? And she just gave me a copy of the Balakanda, said, why don't you read it? And let's talk about it. And as I was reading the Balakanda of the Ramayana, here I was reading, a chapter a day, sometimes a few days. And, you know, if you've ever read the Balakanda of the Ramayana, this is the opening book of the Ramayana. There's an interjection of story after story of this rishi, this sage, Vishwamitra, who is the one of the gurus of Rama and Lakshmana. And, you know, I just became obsessed and fascinated with the stories of this sage. And the stories are really his own journey of starting off as a kshatriya, a king, and through his own power of will and resolve, transforming himself into a Brahmin because he has in his head that that's a higher power somehow. So in my mind, not only did it touch upon issues that I grew up trying to understand, which is what is this power of Brahman identity and social status and hierarchy, but also how do these stories kind of interject themselves into discussions, discourses about social identity in a way that I was not expecting at the time. The story is only half told. I would read during the day Sanskrit literature, the Ramayana. And in the afternoons, I would go to my father's best friend. So this is, I was reading with my mother's best friend, the Ramayana, and I would go and sit with my father's best friend, a fellow named Vaman Kolhatkar, who has a, you know, he plays a prominent role in my, in this book. But he himself is a kirtankar. He's a son of a kirtankar, in fact, and it's keeping a tradition alive of Puranic narrative performance within the kind of Maharashtrian bhakti world. And he would tell me the same stories of Vishwamitra, but in an oral performative style, sitting in his veranda, you know, in the evening while I was madly scratching at mosquito bites that were you know, attacking my body while desperately trying to keep my concentration at his just beautiful mode of storytelling that he was doing. So that was the birth of the book, the realization that the same stories, the same issues, the same kind of crises of identity not only have existed in the textual traditions that we look at as Indologists, Sanskritists, however you want to term it, but also that they occupy a certain space within oral performative traditions today, right? Or in the year 2000, as it were.
Well, one of the interesting, the topic of your book is absolutely fascinating, but also the methodology. I currently have the good fortune of co-authoring a paper where we're actually going to try and look at some lived religious performative traditions in tandem with Sanskritic goddess narratives. Mm-hmm. Not always done. There's not always the opportunity to. If there is the opportunity, not all scholars have the predilection or training or inclination to tackle that scope. And so one of the things we should say about your book, maybe right off the top, is about the kind of data you use and the range of motion. Want to say a bit about that?
Absolutely. So that we can continue the story where I left off in some ways, which is that at that moment, I was being trained in two different disciplines in Berkeley. One was with Robert Goldman, who was teaching me really how to read Sanskrit texts with a careful attention to particularly to commentary, but also to framing devices and ways in which you can historicize texts beyond just treating them as inert reflections of a timeless history. So that was one side of my training. The other side of my training was working with Alan Dundas, who has passed away since that time, but who really is one of the kind of modern fathers of American or North American folklore studies. And you know, really the kind of the greatest sort of advocate for understanding what he called oral literary criticism, right? The way in which stories are performed impacts the way in which the meaning of the story is brought to life. So those kind of informed my initial data sets, my initial doctoral work, which this book is an ultimate kind of regrowth out of. The initial doctoral work was kind of split personality work, where half of each chapter was a study of texts, the other half was a study of oral performance in Marathi, in these Marathi kirtan traditions. That was my initial data set, right, which was Sanskrit texts, mostly epic texts and Puranic texts, and then looking at oral narrative performance. What I realized after finishing the dissertation and then rethinking how this is going to turn into a book is that these are really just two data points in a much more diverse and vast and, in some ways almost impossible to describe, a kind of sea of data points that's almost impossible to describe. And like you were saying, it's really hard to gain sufficient training in all of those. But I realized in some ways that if I were to tell an adequate kind of long durée narrative of the Vishvamitra narratives of why these stories were so important, even, you know, in the epic Ramayana itself and in the year 2000, one needed to do a survey like that. So for the book, my field of data expanded rapidly. So the first chapter, if we want to get into the chapters, I can kind of outline it for you. The first chapter really focuses on the early Vedic and other late Vedic sources for Vishvamitra. So I had to kind of become an amateur Vedicist for that chapter, really to try to understand how Vishvamitra worked in the Vaidika, the tradition of mantras and their exegesis within the Brahmanas. The epics form the second chapter of the book, in which I kind of examine how then Vishvamitra is understood within the Ramayana and Mahabharata, and key kind of points of debate between those two epics. The third chapter focuses on the early Puranic tradition. The fourth chapter goes into regional Puranic traditions, right? How in various regions, particularly in Gujarat, that Vishvamitra gets localized, put into a certain kind of place within the tradition. I switch also then in the fifth chapter to looking at early Marathi narratives that are coming from non-Brahmin sources on Vishvamitra, and telling in some ways a different story, a story of Vishvamitra as a villain, not as a guy who willfully changed his varna, his caste. And then in the last chapter, I bring back our family friend, Vaman Kolhatkar, and look at how oral performed narratives, visual narratives in film and on TV, have started depicting Vishvamitra in a different modern sense in the 20th century.
So in looking at this wide array of data points on what we may call, say, the cultural continuum as pertains to Indian narrative, Indian myth, Indian storytelling, what are you advancing as your sort of central takeaway position argument? What does the book show with all of this data?
Mm-hmm. No, it's an excellent question. Of course, the larger issues that I was interested in some ways is a conversation with this approach that Sheldon Pollack has really been the kind of at the center of, which is trying to understand what literary culture has done for readerships of Sanskrit texts, right, in the pre-modern world. What I was interested in is if we can think of other types of cultures besides just the literary, besides just the certain kind of, you know, elite poetic, refined, courtly tradition that Pollack and others talk about. Instead of, if we can think of what I call a public mythological culture, what did that do, and how did it work? Did it have the same rules as, let's say, a Mahakavya in the Gupta court? Does it operate with the same kind of rules, or does it have a different set of interests and modes of inflection? And that's what I think the book, if it outlines anything, it shows how this mythological culture works, what I tried to argue in the book is that it brings into being a certain story world that it attaches to the real world of its audiences, it's public.
And is that story world, just for the sake of teasing out some of the insights, would you say that story world is evidenced in the Sanskrit narratives primarily, in the more modern performances primarily, or you know, indeed, how do these very different milieu relate to the story world?
Well, that's a good question. The story world is brought into being through the narratives themselves, right? So the media of the bringing into being in some ways is not as relevant. So they're all bringing into being story worlds, contemporary oral performances, ancient Sanskrit written texts. Inscriptions on stone, images, iconography, all of these are somehow conjuring up story worlds. This is incidentally a narratological concept. David Herman is who I'm bringing this from, the idea of story worlds. The key, though, is that to me is that different types of performances, whether they're in texts or whether they're live oral performances, their objective is what I call sort of trying to fix the narrative, right? With all of the various implications of that word of fixing, right? Not only crystallizing, solidifying, putting into place a particular narrative in a situation or in a setting, but also to correct it in some way, right? To offer the true story, the most valid or the most effective way of understanding, in my case, how Vishwamitra was able to become a Brahmin and gain this social power that is crucially at stake in the story. But in all stories, I would say one can analyze it that way, which is how does a particular performer, whether it's an author, a written a writer, or whether it's an oral performer, whether it's someone who's drawing an image, right? How do they fix a story within a larger fluid tradition of that particular narrative?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So if we take, for example, if we limit our scope to the early chapters of your book, and we're looking for, say, at quote-unquote the Vishwamitra story in Vedic and epic sources, tell us a bit about the texture, because surely there are variants. And one can think that each text will offer a peephole into some Vishwamitra, or that each text itself is sort of a part of a patchwork quilt. Or, you know, tell us about the process of how you regard the variations across text.
Well, yeah, what I tried to do, I mean, in different contexts, I try to follow the data in some ways, but maybe the most important moment that we can focus on in terms of thinking of variation, and then maybe the one that I spent the most time thinking about, was the variation between the two epics, right, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, in handling this case of an unusual Brahmin, right? So, and maybe to step back one step further, the reason why it's unusual is itself something worth thinking about, because what I found, at least based on the data I looked at in the Vedas, is that maybe it wasn't so unusual for Vishwamitra to have been a kshatriya, right? Someone belonging to this type of human that was Rajanya, is in particular is how he's referred to, who is somehow a prince, a king, and also a Brahmin. So in the kind of texts that describe Vishwamitra's social standing, he's described as being both. And it doesn't seem to be such a big deal, at least in these texts, that he can be both. And this is one of the things that I saw is historically coming into place in the epic tradition, this impossibility of someone having two Varna statuses at the same time. So if Vishwamitra is described both as Rajanya, as a king, or as a royal status, and as a Brahmana, the epics had to find a narrative that could sufficiently explain how he's referred to as both. And the epics come up with a narrative of change, right? So he starts as a Kshatriya and becomes a Brahman. Now the Ramayana, at least in my argument, in the book, the Ramayana tells this as a story of willful triumph, right? As a self-transformation in which he sheds all of his kshatriya qualities one by one and acquires brahminical qualities, thereby again reinforcing socially the kind of ideology of why Brahmins should be respected more than others. The Mahabharata, on the other hand, seems to be a lot more uncomfortable with his blend of Kshatriya and Brahmin qualities. To them, he still has a certain irascibility and fiery energy that other characters such as Parshurama, who you talked about in a previous podcast, and Drona in particular, embody some of these problematic blends of Kshatriya qualities, of royal qualities, as well as Brahminical qualities. And for the Mahabharata, that seemed to be a certain problematic figure. So his slot in their mythological kind of worldview, I found to be variant than the Ramayana.
Let's just a random comment. It's interesting that the Mahabharata in general seems to always present the pitfalls for Brahmins of behaving like Kshatriyas, mm-hmm. or having this fiery temperament, always something to be subdued, controlled, sublimated, domesticated in some way. Mm-hmm. A number of them come to mind, but I just recently spent a bunch of time thinking about Sringan. Parikshit put the snake over his Shamika's neck, and then he ends up cursing Parikshit to die. And this is somehow this Vishwamitra-like nature is problematic even in the Brahmanas of mm-hmm. the Mahabharata, much less this hybrid or even pretender sort of figure. But more towards your work, I'd like to point out that there is a very useful URL, a website that for folks like me is just a treasure trove. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the companion site and what you've done with the quote-unquote variants of this text.
Ah, okay. I almost forgot about the companion site. It's been so long.
That's yes. My job.
No, so there was a question. I mean, the research comes from also my own translations of the various versions of these narratives of Vishwamitra. So there's a question about what does one do with these, Oxford, OUP, for all of their generous support, they were a bit hesitant to add another 100 pages of translations. So the kind of forward thinking at the time was to develop a companion website in which the translations of my translations of these epic and Puranic texts are freely available for download. So it has all of the Vishwamitra narratives, kind of nicely organized.
So we'll definitely link the URL for that site to this podcast as well. Mm-hmm. This is a topic that we touched on a fair bit in our interview about Parashurama. Would you say that there are key features that are essential for the Vishwamitra story? Would you say that some of the variations, I mean, I'm speaking to sort of an audience who may not have looked at the stories individually. Would you say, you know, to what extent is there a Vishwamitra story with variants, or to what extent is it a composite that you're creating, or to what extent are you looking at a particular iteration in the Puranas, for example? Could you say a bit about that?
In some ways, it's like all story cycles in some ways, that it kind of depends on the storyteller, which narrative takes prominence for them when they think of the particular name of the character, right? So go back to my initial moments of research. So while our family friend, Vaman Kolhatkar, the kirtan singer, he was able to tell me every single narrative that he knew about Vishwamitra, for most other contemporary consultants that I had, right, our family or even shopkeepers who I would ask them, hey, do you know Vishwamitra and what do you know about him? For most contemporary folks, I would say, there are two things that stand out about Vishwamitra in India. One is his irascibility and his anger and his readiness to curse, lifting his arm up and delivering a curse at the moment's insult. Right? That characteristic is just embedded within the modern understanding, contemporary understanding of Vishwamitra. And the other contemporary, immediate association with Vishwamitra is the fact that he was seduced by the apsara, the nymph Menaka. Right? These are the two story or the two motifs that are deeply, deeply associated with Vishwamitra in the modern period. And if I had my druthers, right, if I were to redo this book, I might consider a reverse history of Vishwamitra, where I start with these two key features that we all know and do a deep dive, right? Where did these come from? Because in fact, if you go all the way back to the Vedic tradition, that irascibility is there, right? From the very first story of Shunashepa that we find, in which Vishwamitra curses his own sons to become outcasts, dog cookers as the kind of slur that's used to describe them, right? Shwapakas, Shwapachas. So from that very first kind of narrative of Vishwamitra, that irascibility is there. But in each historical moment, in some ways, it gains a different inflection and a different coming to terms with its genealogy. Really, another way, it's social genealogy, I would say.
I think that's one of the most fascinating features I find about mm-hmm. about myth, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like all story, there's this multivalence, but there's this extreme breadth of, you know, speaking to something in the moment in sort of the generation or the epoch of composition, but also speaking to something much broader, close to timeless, if timelessness even exists. But, you know, this idea that, you know, he's archetypal fire, right? There's lust, mm-hmm. there's anger, there's the Kshatriya nature. This is so part of his MO that you can't quite whittle that part away, no matter how you wish to reframe him.
Well, right. What's interesting to me is that we can now maybe assert that it's a part of his Kshatriya identity, right? But that itself is an ideological spin in some ways on a much deeper inner anxiety, perhaps, of Brahminhood, which is that if you go all the way back to the first iterations of Vishwamitra, when he was still very much part of Vedic tradition, there was a deep concern within, there is a deep concern even today within Vedic or Vaidikas of being able to control one's speech. So the deep anxieties there are being in some ways mapped onto a different varna, right? A different caste within the narrative tradition. So I wouldn't want to, I would hesitate to just automatically assume that these are kshatriya behavioral characteristics, but rather it's a Brahmin mapping of human characteristics, I would say, onto the other, right? Onto a certain non-Brahmin trait. And Vishwamitra comes to embody that Brahmin others. This is one of the arguments of the book, is that he represents within, at the very edge of Brahmanhood, you could say, those features that you shouldn't have as a good Brahmin, as a quote unquote good Brahmin.
Indeed, he's sort of, his fiery temperament is ascribed as the domain of Kshatriyas through the lens of this, you know, we're looking, Brahmanic ideology is the lens of these texts. So you touch on and speak to really what you say in your subtitle, right? The construction of Brahmin power in Hindu mythology. So say more about that. Say what you've learned about the construction of Brahmin power, the ways in which this character speaks the construction of Brahmin power. That's so much at the heart of your book, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's hard to speak about it, especially in times in which we're learning about, you know, in some ways very brutal forms of social power that are going on in the world around us. It's difficult to speak of power. But in the mythological tradition, you know, power is a nefarious and insidious thing, right? It's a way to define boundaries, but also exclude people from being inside of the boundary. The narratives of Vishwamitra in some ways are about entering into Brahmanhood, right? How can one become a Brahmin? But the way in which they're told often, not always, but at least within the epics, certainly, and in most Puranas, the door is in some ways closed to ordinary people. Right? It's not possible for ordinary non-Brahmins to ever imagine themselves doing the kinds of ascetic practice that Vishwamitra had to do to become this high status Brahmin sage. He had to do ascetic practice for 14,000 years, some extraordinary number of years. Or he had to have divine intervention in the Puranas. In the Puranas, he has to find a sacred sacred tirtha in which he was able to transform his physical body and so on. But for it becomes a kind of a story of an impossible transformation for ordinary people. But interestingly, there's a narrative of Vishwamitra in which he's very much portrayed as a villain, which did find, I would say, a wider audience, and it's one of the more powerful narratives of abjection and suffering ever told, which is a story of Harishchandra, and I deal with that story mostly in chapters 5 and 6 of the book, the last section of the book, in which his status as being at the margins of Brahmanhood and a symbol of the extreme irascibility and power of Brahmins within the Hindu social world is seen as a threat, right? It's seen as a site of potential villainy, in especially for this good king Harishchandra, who he and his wife and his son are tormented mercilessly, really, by Vishwamitra, who takes advantage of every privilege he has as a Brahmin. And in the end, I think anyone can see, whether Brahmin or non-Brahmin, the potential for abuse of this social status that comes with Brahminhood in traditional South Asian society. Yeah.
So what do you see? There's so much there. So much is such an interesting topic, timely, even timeless and timely. But what do you see in terms of, let's just focus a little bit on the, I want to ask a little bit more about the performances towards the end of this podcast, but let's focus, for example, on the Harishchandra story. So we're looking specifically at Vishvamitra within the confines of the Markandeya Purana. What would you say is the primary function, theme, moral motif? How do you think that narrative is functioning in its Markandeya Purana iteration?
Well, with the Markandeya, I should ask you. Actually, you're the expert on the Markandeya.
I just play dumb on this podcast. Well, sometimes I'm not playing, but anyhow, and I'm just curious.
I was curious too. Actually, in fact, we can talk about that. The Harishchandra narrative has also a wide range of variation, and it has. It has a rich and robust set of regional traditions in medieval and contemporary South Asia, so that it's told differently in Maharashtra, it's told differently in the South, in Bengal, in Gujarat, and in the Hindi-speaking areas. So, in some ways, you could do a many Harishchandras book, just like the famous many Ramayanas books, and there was this. Maybe that's on the back burner at some point in the future. There will be people listening to this podcast who were invited long ago to be part of this. But it's impossible to speak of a single Harishchandra narrative in that way. There are many Harishchandras. Interestingly, he's hard to find, relatively speaking. This story is hard to find in the Sanskrit classical tradition. And in fact, the first time it's told historically in any great length is in the Markandeya Purana that you referenced to. And then after that, the only really other major Puranic version is in this other medieval Purana called the Devi Bhagavata, which knows the Markandeya quite well and is in fact having a conversation with the Markandeya version. But the Markandeya version comes kind of interjected in some ways, right? It's sort of stuck into this series of four questions that birds are being asked, right? The speakers are birds, if I remember correctly.
Four birds who proxy for Markandeya.
That's right. These birds who happen to have been on the Mahabharata battlefield and are better sources for answering these questions about the Mahabharata. But the story is told, if I remember correctly, to answer a kind of a stupid trivia question in some ways about the Mahabharata, which is why did the sons of the Pandavas die so young? and to give the answer, this long and complex story of, you know, abuse of Brahmin social power and privilege is told, is along with like complete abjection of the kshatriya, of the king, right, the noble king Harishchandra. So it's a puzzling story in the Markandeya. It doesn't really go along very well with the other aspects of it. I tried to make sense of it in some ways by thinking about narrative context, right? So after the story of Harishchandra, there's a long discussion of dualistic Vedanta, if I remember correctly, between I'm forgetting the characters now. Who
Jada and Sumati, I think.
Right.
I think this is that might be the portion where they talk about poverty and virtue dharmas.
Mm-hmm.
I believe.
Yeah, it's sort of attributed to a Dattatreya tradition, I think, that's coming out of that region. So in some ways, to me, I felt like that was an answer that was being offered. Right, the Markandeya was in some ways offering the answer of non-dual. A non-dual yoga tradition is what it is. I'm forgetting what this context is now. But a non-dual yoga tradition is being offered as a solution in some ways to the question of suffering, the universal question of why do bad things happen to good people, and what should good people do about it? The answer that's being offered by the Markandeya Purana, by juxtaposing this story with a long discussion, a philosophical discussion, is of how to achieve liberation while still stuck in suffering in some ways.
Indeed. Now, since you've had the luxury of looking at textual traditions, more recent or even modern, current performative traditions, you have a unique vantage point, or at least few and far between are the scholars who have this vantage point, I'd say. Do you see a tension between the two? Do you see a need to reconcile the two? Like, how do you see a tension between what you see in terms of ancient Indian Sanskrit text versus the performative traditions where, for example, Vishwamitra may be vilified in some way? I mean, can you talk about that tension?
Well, the tension comes only when we don't know what happened in between, right? And we can't really, there's a discontinuity. When we see discontinuity, that's where tension comes from. So of course, one thing that we really need more of, and which scholars such as yourself and many others are doing more of, which is try to fill in the blanks, right? Fill in the early modern, what happens to Sanskrit culture, mythological culture, in the early modern period, prior to the onset of colonial presence in South Asia. The more we understand about that time period, I think the less we'll see a massive disjunction between classical or early texts versus contemporary refractions of those texts.
Are you still interested in or studying Vishwamitra?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel I'm always interested in Vishwamitra. I'm not sure what more I can do with Vishwamitra. Our family friend again, Vaman Kolhatkar, sort of teased me, so apparently I don't really know much about these things, but apparently my family is of the Vasishta Gotra, and his family is of the Vishwamitra Gotra. So he always thought it was amusing that here's a Vasishta Brahman studying Vishwamitra Brahman, so I'm not sure how much more a Vasishta Brahman can say about Vishwamitra. I'm always interested. New things or ever appear.
What are you currently working on?
So I've switched. In some ways, I've switched gears. So, like I mentioned before, I have kind of two different hats. One is as a Sanskritist, student of Sanskrit, and the other is as a folklore scholar. So what I'm hoping to do is to work on, and I have been working on these storytelling collections that started getting popular in the early second millennium, specifically the Vetala, Panchavimshati, the 25 tales of the Vetala. And I've been doing more of a text-centered philological or maybe new philological analysis, and which eventually there'll be a translation coming out soon of these 25 tales of the Vetala, to try to understand how a new kind of public storytelling culture, manuscript culture, really grew and proliferated in the early second millennium. And particularly, caste is in some ways still there in my interests and of social status and social power. Of particular interest to me is how these traditions were able to cross both religious boundaries with relative ease. So the Jains were interested in these same narrative traditions, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, right? It was a multi-religious sphere in some ways of narrative culture that moved across Persian and Sanskrit and vernacular languages, and really became what I call a public a public culture, pre-modern public culture in the second millennium. So that's where my interests are currently, is trying to understand popular literary traditions, folk cultures in the early second millennium.
So assuming the planet's still here and so is this podcast, you're very welcome to come back and talk about subsequent works. Is there anything else about the book you hope to touch on today?
Well, I hope people, you know, enjoy it if you haven't seen it. I think there's a lot in there, I suppose. I'm flattered and thrilled to be asked to speak about it.
Well, it's a fascinating book on a number of levels, not least of which it affords insight into Brahmanic power, along with this fascinating figure of ancient India that survived to modern day, Vishwamitra. And it really bespeaks the interplay between the vitality of lived performances and ancient Indian mythological performances, in which you find Pauranikas or bards as part of these ancient narratives. And so it's really, we look at texts and it's really hard to understand the very fluid contexts that empowered and enlivened the text. And, you know, it's a fine line we tread, I feel. And so there's lots of fascinating data in the book. Once again, we've been speaking about Crossing the Lines of Caste, Vishwamitra and the Construction of Brahmin Power in Hindu Mythology. And we've been speaking with, by the way, it's OUP 2015. There is a companion site to the book that I will link in this podcast. We have been speaking with the book's author, Dr. Adish Sate of University of British Columbia, who is well ahead of the curve of academics, podcasting, and creating educational materials for distance learners. So we will also have some links to his YouTube material. Thank you very much for appearing on the program today.
Hey, thanks so much, Raj. It was a pleasure and an honor to be invited. And yeah, I love the podcast and love what you're doing.
Thanks very much. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep thinking, keep listening, and keep contemplating the relationship between performance and written text. Take care.